This episode of the Slow Melt Maker Series is sponsored by Cacao Cucina, the control you need to craft your chocolate. Reliable chocolate making machinery built in the USA. Use Slow Melt 10 at cacaocucina.com. Contact us for a 10% discount through September 1st. This episode is also supported by Chocolate Alchemy, supplier of the largest selection of fine flavor cocoa beans, chocolate making equipment, and volumes of free chocolate making information. They've been helping home chocolate makers and bean-to-bar professionals for over 14 years. Visit chocolatealchemy.com and enter SLOWMELT at checkout to receive 10% off any retail cocoa bean order.
Welcome to the Slow Melt Makers Series. I'm Simran Sethi, and today I'm speaking with Cynthia Leung and David Castellon, the co-founders of Soma Chocolate Maker, based in Toronto, Canada. Sin and David, I am so excited to speak with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's nice for me to finally get to hear the stories behind your chocolate, which I've been savoring for a long time. So tell me a little bit on how you learned to savor chocolate.
My history with chocolate goes way back because I was a pastry chef for a long time. And when I was a pastry chef working in restaurants and stuff in the 80s, when you would order chocolate, no one talked about origins. You would just order your chocolate. It might be a different brand like Calibo or Lindt or whatever, but you would just order chocolate and it would come in and you'd melt it and use it and you wouldn't think about it too much. I mean, it still tasted good and stuff, but you wouldn't think about origins. But around the late 80s or 1990, Valrhona came out with separate origins, Manjari, which was our favorite, but also Guanaja and Carib and all the other ones. And the rep for Valrhona came around. His name is Frederick Bau. Not the rep, but he was a technologist or the chocolate guy for them. And he came around and he explained how Manjari was from beans from the Indian Ocean. And he suggested uses for it and had berry flavors and stuff. So that kind of piqued my interest. A bunch of years later, when we started Soma, we had tasted Damori's Madagascar, which was Manjari times a thousand. It had all that fruit, but it was like the super interesting bar that kind of blew our minds and kind of opened up, you know, the flavor potential of chocolate. And it was at this around the same time when we were starting, when I had taken this course to learn how to make chocolate.
So tell us about that origin story.
Well, Cynthia and I wanted to start a business. You know, we were looking around at some spaces. We found a little space and we decided that it was really too small to be a pastry shop, but that we could probably do chocolate together. It sounded like a fun project. I really wanted to learn how to do chocolate panning. And I found a course in Hayward, California called the Richardson Researches. So this was a very small little studio, but they taught chocolate technology to employees from large companies like Mars and stuff. There's a week-long course. Within that course, where we did learn panning, but within that course, we also learned how to make chocolate from the bean. So we roasted, winnowed, all that stuff. And that ended up being more interesting than panning for me.
What is panning?
Panning is like coating nuts with chocolate and you know, Smarties, anything that's coat like little, like Advil or pills, all that stuff. And when we started, we had Maricel's book, and then we also, like, when you would Google back then, this is 2003, 2002, when you Googled chocolate makers, that's what would come up, Grenada Chocolate Factory, and they had the cute little melanger, and their setup was enviable for us at the time. And that's how we got into it.
So, Sin, was your background also in pastry or in chocolate? How did you come to this?
So I was working as an architect at the time, and David was working at a pastry chef. We were a couple, both working, not seeing a lot of each other. And I mean, we've always been interested in food, and we were sort of bouncing around business ideas that we could do together and sort of accentuate our own strengths and what we bring into it. And being from architecture, we had found this little space in an abandoned distillery where they used to make whiskey, and they were trying to fill it with makers. So there was a coffee roaster, beer maker. So we thought this would be the perfect space, except it was the last space. It was close to the washrooms. It had no real ceiling on it. So, I mean, we sort of built it out, not really knowing what was going to happen with this, because there was no precedent of little companies making chocolate. So we just, we winged it. And we started out with 450 square feet, and that's how we started. And eventually we both could quit our jobs after about a year.
We started out near the washroom, 450 feet. Where are you today?
So after 2 years, we moved out of that space because it was getting kind of crazy. Somebody would put their production tray down and wait for that person just to go to the washroom and then move everything around. We were seriously lacking space because, I mean, chocolate making takes big machines, and 450 square feet just isn't a lot. And we had a small retail store because we were young and full of ideas. We wanted to make hot chocolate, and we wanted to do gelato and bake, and we were just so excited about all the possibilities that we just started doing everything all at once. And when we ran out of space, there was another space two doors down that we had moved into, and that was 3,000 square feet. And I mean, with every iteration of what you're trying to do, you're more aware of how to plan your space and just how more efficient you can work, and we could get more machines and do more creative stuff out of that location.
How do you define your company? Are you a craft maker, a specialty maker, small batch, mid-sized? What are you?
Good question. Because I think we're different than some of the newer companies. We started before the term bean to bar came into existence. We just called it microbatch. We kind of borrowed that term from the brewing movement at the time. I don't know if it happened anywhere else, but in Toronto there was all sorts of small brewers starting. So we kind of equated what we were doing to brewing. So what would make us different is that we don't just do bars, we do all sorts of things. We do cookies, we do gelato, we do truffles, ganaches, caramels, all that. A lot of things that can be made out of chocolate we make, and we also make chocolate. So I think that there are a few people that do that now, but a lot of the companies that you would call bean to bar now basically buy beans, roast them, conch them, make them into bars, and that's the end of their product line. Most of our sales come from our retail stores. So we have two retail stores and a factory. In total, about 10,000 square feet, about 40 employees. Our next project this year is to build out a new factory, which will very much be our home base, and we'll set it up as well as we can for the next little while. And we're looking forward to having a home base to just basically do what we do, explore chocolate making.
Would you say that's like the common thread in all of the delicious products you make, that the touchstone is chocolate?
I think we often say it, that we like to just explore the world of chocolate. And part of it is making chocolate, and then part of it is using it in different ways. Everything has its own technique, and it's all fun, and Cynthia gets to stretch out with flavors and stuff. She's come into the world of chocolate with her own point of view, and she has a lot of fun working on truffle ganache flavors and stretching what we can do with chocolate, just because she doesn't come from the pastry world and she's not stuck in a certain frame of mind.
I think that's a tremendous asset. Can you tell me one of the most far out inclusions, something that you've worked with that you, like, even you didn't know if it was going to work or not, but you're like, you know what, I'm going to put this in some chocolate and we're going to see what happens.
We've messed around quite a bit and definitely some things don't work.
So, you know, you're kicking off our maker series, and I like to think this series is really for makers. Right. I mean, for us chocolate eaters too, for sure, but that anything you share is kind of also in service of people who are starting out making chocolate. So would you mind talking about some of those failures?
Failures. The big one, well, when we first started in around 2003, everyone was doing like salted caramels. I mean, I'm sure people were doing it before, but everyone wanted to have these salted caramels. So I had the brilliant idea of thinking, well, if you can do salted caramels, you should be able to do a MSG caramel. And so I added some MSG to chocolate. We'll never, ever, ever do that again.
And the lines were out the door for that one.
Yeah. We didn't actually sell it. It didn't make it past our R&D station.
So what's worked really well that surprised you?
Well, Toronto is a very cosmopolitan place. You can drive around and go to like a Persian restaurant. There's a lot of Chinese markets and you can get food from all over the world. And so we tend to explore that because we always find ourselves in those markets. A lot of the Middle Eastern flavors ended up in our products over the last few years. We use sumac a lot, barberries, which are from, well, they're used a lot in Iran. They go really well with chocolate.
Anything you want to add, Sen?
Everywhere we travel, there's always inspiration there. And when we went to Thailand, there all those amazing spices and ingredients came back with us and just became part of us. So that Christmas collection, there was a lot of Southeast Asian inspiration.
This episode is brought to you by Rotar Chocolate Machines, a chocolate grinder designed and built by a chocolate maker for chocolate makers and made in the United States. Get all of the details at www.rotar.com. This episode is also brought to you by Blue Apron, the meal delivery service that works directly with artisanal purveyors and family-run farms to bring meals to your door. Get $30 off your first order plus free shipping at blueapron.com/chocolate.
One of the things that I think really separates the craft or specialized chocolate industry from the mass confection industry is, of course, the idea of consistency. Like, we want something that's familiar, but we have a great appetite for serendipity. Your line is so expansive. Is that something that you've ever thought about, like maybe in reverse, like, whoa, we might need to rein it in a little bit, because even though we're traveling around the world and have all these flavors we want to bring back, we do want people to continue to find what's familiar to them.
We've done a lot of experiments, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And even though if it might have been sort of an off idea in the beginning, people get familiar with it as they are regulars and they get it all the time. So we've had a couple actually kneel down and beg us not to get rid of something. So,
well, you have to tell me what that is.
I think it was just a size.
Very interesting. Okay, so tell me, from where do you source your beans and what origins are you working with right now?
It was always interesting for us to have a lot of origins around for us to work with, because we also do blends and stuff. And we also source from different methods, I guess. We do have a broker that really is great, and we work with him to explore a lot of the harder to get varieties, especially from Venezuela, like Porcelana, Chuao, Choroni, Chama, Vihia. And then we've also made, personal connections, like our guy in Jamaica, Desmond, where we can go visit him and, you know, we talk cacao beans with him. And that's a little bit more personal, where you can tell him what you want and he does his best to give it to you. When we first started in 2003, I would call these brokers up And one of them told me that there was only 11 companies on their list. There's only 11 companies buying cocoa beans in all of North America. So I would call them up and say, you know, I want 3 bags. And they would basically laugh because 3 bags wasn't really on their radar at the time.
Meaning such a small amount wasn't on their radar?
The small amount, yeah, exactly. The first guy that helped us out, John Kehoe, very nice guy. And he kind of saw, you know, kind of what we were doing. And then he agreed to sell us 3 bags. And that was the start of our sourcing. If you fast forward to now, 2017, you basically get an email every day from someone who wants to sell you cocoa beans, and they'll send you samples. And it's a completely different world where we have the luxury of having a lot of great cocoa getting sent to us.
Is there any cocoa that's really stood out as being foundational to your line?
For some reason, we've always ended up with Venezuela because we had some connections there. And so much great stuff comes from Venezuela. And Jamaica, of course, recently, because of Desmond, we like that stuff. And then, you know, there's the standards like Madagascar. I mean, everyone likes Akasin's beans. They're kind of a standard.
That's Bertil Akasin, and much of the cacao that ends up in a lot of the specialty or craft chocolate bars comes from his plantation in Madagascar.
Exactly. I think that was the second origin we ever received. The last time I talked to him, he remembered helping John Kehoe load a bag of cocoa beans into the back seat of his car to send to Canada for us to use.
That's great. What do you wish chocolate eaters, like, of course, the ones who come into your shop probably are well aware of this now, but for the rest of us, what do you wish that we understood about chocolate making that may not be out there in the world for them to know?
You know, in the beginning, when we started, and especially a bit later, when the American makers like Patrick and Rogue started to talk about this, their big problem was that people didn't understand what a chocolate maker was versus a chocolate here, like someone who would melt down chocolate and make truffles. That's always been a bit of a confusion in the beginning, especially with our customers. And one of the reasons why Cynthia laid out our factory with lots of windows where you could see the mélangeur working, and you can see the roaster, and you can see us doing things that weren't typical in a normal chocolate shop, where you would see people maybe making truffles or dipping stuff in chocolate. Our store was a little bit different, where you would go and see cocoa bean roasted, you would smell that, you would see you wouldn't see our winnower, that was in the back, but you know, you'd see nibs and you'd see raw materials that were a little bit different than usual. So our customers, I think, got a little bit of a connection to that, and they found that part interesting, and we were able to connect with them on that level, that we were making something a little bit different. So it's, you know, it's all about communication and what people perceive. And I think now, 2017, I think people can recognize the difference between a chocolate maker and a chocolatier, I hope.
Yeah, or they will now. What suggestion do you have for up-and-coming makers?
I think there's so many new makers out there. And when we started, it was pretty crazy because we didn't know that much about business or chocolate making. So we had to learn as we went, but there was a lot of bad batches of chocolate being made in the beginning because, I mean, we all have to start somewhere. My advice is just, if the batch is flawed, don't release it. We have batches that just don't turn out, whether it be the beans or something happened during the process, but we take it as a loss and we throw it out, or we use it to clean out our machines, or some of it's just still sitting there. But it does more harm to your business to release something. You just have to take it as a loss. Also, to keep an extra set of clothes handy, because conching makes you smell really stinky like socks. So if you're going to go out right after work, it's probably a good idea to keep an extra set of clothes around.
That is excellent and unexpected. And I think what you're saying is so spot on around throwing out what isn't reflective of your brand and delicious enough, because I think that really is a challenge for the whole definition of what craft chocolate is. And I remember one of the first bars I had was really off. You know, a company had turned a defect into an attribute, and there was a voice in my head that said, craft chocolate isn't for you. Like, this does not taste good. And then, of course, fortunately, there were a number of bars that were super delicious.
Right.
That kind of countered that. And there was my growing confidence in my own sense of taste. But had I only tried that bar, had I not been writing a book, honestly, on, you know, the industry at the time, I would have probably just said, you know what, I'm going to spend that extra money somewhere else, because that's not an experience I want to have.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of chocolate makers that agree with that sort of thinking, that there's just a lot of bad chocolate out there. And for a consumer, it wouldn't be like our first experience when you asked us about the Madagascar. That was the breakthrough chocolate for us. It was the first notion that this could be so much more, and there could be so many more layers to just what you would get in the grocery store.
And we're going to experience one of those layers right now. I am so excited. We'll be tasting the Soma Porcelana Bar. And as I open it, would you tell me a little bit about the story behind this bar?
So this bar, when we first started, it was the famous white bean that was considered the holy grail of beans. Mm-hmm. Since it was considered to be such a pure criollo.
Explain what criollo is.
It is a genus type of the cocoa bean, and it is considered the highest quality one. So Porcelana it's notoriously hard to grow. It's susceptible to insects, fragile. It almost disappeared off the face of the earth. They look like little small melons. So when we first started, we heard about these famous beans from Maricel's book. And of course, we couldn't get it because there was so little of it being produced. And I don't even think it was coming out of Venezuela. But 12 years later, we finally got these beans. So, wow. I mean, 12 years is a long time.
What does that mean? Do you just go to the cocoa bean broker and say, please, can I have some this year? And they say, no, come back. Or are you going to Venezuela and trying to source them from farmers? What does that look like?
Pretty much it's bugging your broker or anyone that will listen to see if they have what you want. And we just kept saying, like, when we were looking, it was a little bit hard to find these rare beans. Because, you know, no one knew who Soma Chocolate was. No one care to sell their beans to such a small company. It was a very, very small crop, and lots of buyers, lots of people wanted it, especially in Europe. So we were competing with those guys, but we managed, after bugging the broker enough, that he finally found us some, and we just loved the sample so much. We bought it all, as much as we could, and we made this chocolate, and it's the pure criollo. You know, even the name Porcelana, meaning porcelain or white. It has this kind of majestic, noble name.
Can you talk to me about this mold? Because it's absolutely exquisite. We've got cacao pods, and we've got a little bird, and we've got the maple leaf to show us that you're Canadian, and cocoa blossoms. How labor intensive is it to create something like this?
It's about 2 years labor intensive.
Wow, okay.
We've always wanted to do our own custom mold, like most chocolate makers will eventually on that journey want to do their own custom mold. Or maybe some people right at the beginning, they start big enough that they can afford it. But it takes us a little bit longer to do everything, because we sort of insist on trying to do everything ourselves. But I had tried out so many different designs of bars, and I just wanted to sort of capture that whole world of cacao in one mold, which is kind of a high order to ask for. But I just started sketching everything about our process of before we got our beans, and that's the design I came up with. The little bird is sort of a symbol of how wacky we are. And he's got little Converse shoes on. The Canadian, because we're Canadian chocolate makers, and all the different iterations of when that blossom grows on that tree and what it can become.
Gosh.
And what it can become in the world of a chocolate bar from its first idea of being born on that branch. And also I wanted to have a perfect tasting experience, so I wanted 4 millimeters thick, which was a nice thickness so it would melt in your mouth well.
You're making it hard for me to ask a follow-up question on packaging because I'm dying to put this beautiful bar in my mouth. It returns us to origin, right? It very immediately reminds us that cocoa comes from another place, or, you know, from here looks like a really magical place. So tell me now about the packaging itself.
I mean, I've wanted to change our packaging for so many years. So that is an old packaging that will change hopefully this year. But I mean, running our little operation, there's not a lot of time for me to figure out what I want to do with the packaging. So instead of hiring a firm, we just let all the old packaging go until I can find the time to design something new. I wanted to interpret the tasting experience of a single bar into something more tangible, which is very much in line with your podcast on senses and taste. At first, I thought it would be great if we could make a little song for every bar that we do. That's why I was so happy to hear that podcast, because not a lot of people talk about combining different senses other than taste. But music is so perfect because it has variables such as volume and scale, ranging from high to low, sustained notes, chords, where you can taste two notes at the same time. It would just be perfect. But for packaging, I thought, well, I have to do something visual. So when we went to Japan just recently, we went to this store called Pigment. They had 4,000 different pigments to make ink from. And I thought, this place is amazing. It has all these colors. And for visual interpretation of the tasting experience, I thought to represent the layers of flavor or sense of place, high notes, low notes, I could represent that through color and textures and shapes. So each bar, hopefully by the end of this year, will have its own little drawing.
Fantastic. Cross-sensorial, multi-sensorial experience.
Yeah.
I'm gonna break this bar. Tell me what kinds of flavors, aromas first I should be looking for.
So this cocoa, a lot of the cocoa from Venezuela has more of an elegant, nutty, cashew finish rather than this crazy fruit that comes from Madagascar or a lot of other origins. So when you're tasting porcelana, you're going to taste something that's a little bit more subtle. What we taste, I call it grassy, but some of these flavors don't really have words attached to them. I wish there were more words in the English language. There is a little bit of berry in it, some cashew, macadamia nuts, cream. There's a creaminess to the bar because we do add cocoa butter, so there's a little bit more melt than other makers. All in all, a lot of the Venezuelan chocolate has a longer finish, or it seems to us that it has a long finish.
Now it's in my mouth.
Yeah.
What? I couldn't wait anymore. What do you find in the finish?
Maybe I have to eat it right here with you. That's the missing part of this equation.
I'm hearing some sort of weird noise, you guys.
That was us breaking the chocolate bar. That kind of grassy note kind of extends quite deep into.
Yeah. To me, that's also like,
there's some spiciness, yeah.
Where I finally find a hint of that, a flavor of cocoa. Like, I wouldn't call this I find it to be an extremely delicious, but not a very like chocolatey bar.
Hmm. Cocoa is, yeah, it's more of a journey, I guess. Whereas some bars you have that have a lot of that cocoa flavor, a lot of these other more interesting origins have a journey that's maybe starts a little bit at cocoa, but then kind of winds through a bunch of different flavors. And it's more of like a gastronomic experience as opposed to eating kind of a sweet candy bar.
Exactly.
You can have that little quiet moment of tasting all those flavors, and it's a little journey, and you kind of can get lost in it. And I'm no wine taster or anything, but I have to assume that people who are really into wine have that same kind of journey. And we're lucky enough to have this product that we can make that we can influence those flavors and have a similar experience.
And take people on a journey, not only like through this one bar, but through the world.
Well, one of our taglines from earlier on was traveling without moving. It's from the movie Dune. And we had to use that because when you're at a table and you have a bar from Madagascar, a bar from Venezuela, one from, you know, Sao Tome, another one from Java, then what more fitting phrase could there be than traveling without moving? You're tasting all these chocolates and you're getting transported flavor-wise to these crazy exotic places.
Exactly. I'm tasting and listening, and I just found the red fruit.
Red fruit? Yes.
Your tasting notes said red fruit, and I was like, I didn't find it, and then I did. It's like a journey in every... I mean, I don't want to get too whatever, but this is what I love about tasting, like really sitting with chocolate, mm-hmm. is a different kind of magic happens when you're actually paying attention.
Totally. And, you know, I've tasted it a lot, and I just, when we were tasting it, I got a little bit of black pepper there, you know, halfway through that finish. So, and I've never gotten that before. So
yeah.
It's always like it's a journey, and then it's a different journey each time.
And is that different journey for you? Is that something that also is like with every new batch that comes in that you're really trying to express the new harvest or seasonality, or are you trying to recreate what you created in that bar in the Porcelana from the first batch, or how do you manage that?
You know what, because this is one thing that's unspoken, I guess, it's almost every single batch you make at this level is an experiment, and you're tweaking and making changes. And because we're not at the level of manufacture where you can do that at a smaller scale and then ramp up for production, you're basically doing it at production scale each time. And you're part of the journey too, because you're basically making these decisions that are reflected in this batch that you make that is completely done at the end. And whether you have to sell it or not, it's done. And you've invested, you know, your time, but also a lot of money of getting these beans and getting them in there and roasting them and doing all these decisions. It's the chocolate at the end is basically like a receipt for your work. I imagine that if one day we make something that's crazy amazing and I've recorded all the temperatures and everything, that I'd probably want to go back and do the same thing again. But as we're going through it now, I think each time it's still a journey, and it's still basically a series of decisions that you make.
Is that the like cornerstone of the excitement and frustration in this kind of chocolate making?
And no one talks about the frustration. You know, the big thing also is that chocolate, the flavors are changing continually from when you're roasting it. You can roast these beans and they taste amazing. Then you refine them and then some kind of weird flavors come out. Then you conch it and then it tastes different. And then after a few days, it tastes different. And then you age it a few weeks and it tastes even more different. It's not as straightforward as making chocolate and then tasting it at the end, giving a thumbs up, and then that's it. The journey continues after you've finished, and it's continual. So, you know, there's surprises there. We've made chocolate that we've thought tasted terrible, and we were very disappointed. And age it for a while on the shelf, and you go back to it, and you make some bars, and then it's the best thing you've ever tried. So that, I mean, frustration isn't really the word for it. It's just like a roller coaster is a better word, maybe.
Well, thanks for letting me hop on the ride for a minute. That's been really lovely. We've now talked quite a bit about your bars. Tell me a little bit about who inspires you? Like, what chocolate makers are you savoring?
Well, we really loved Demori in the beginning. We went to Japan for this meeting of chocolate makers in Tokyo this year. And we met cacao hunters.
We met both Mayumi and Carlos in Japan. And because we had last year at the Americas, we had won the best in show dark chocolate, and they had won best in show milk chocolate. So we were really happy to meet each other finally, because they weren't at the awards banquet. But we traded bars there in Japan. So it was really nice to meet them. And one of the bars that we love from them is their Arauca bar, their dark 70% Arauca bar. We have a lot of chocolate that we sort of trade and buy, but I think Rogue and Lonohana, the Maru guys, and Dick Taylor, they're all sort of top of their game right now. And Hummingbird and Palette de Bean, fellow Canadians, are really doing really great chocolate right now.
Awesome. Thank you, Cynthia and David, so much for taking this time.
No problem.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Podcast listeners, you can learn more about Soma Chocolate Maker on their website, somachocolate.com. And use the code SLOWMELT to get a discount on their Porcelana bar that we tasted in this episode. You can also order the Maker's Series Tasting Pack, featuring all 9 bars in the Maker's Series, exclusively through chocolopolis.com. Check our website, slowmelt.com, for all details, dates of the promotion, and discount information. To hear shows on the importance of preserving cocoa in stored collections and on how the economic crisis in Venezuela impacts cocoa farmers and the industry at large, check out the Slow Melt episodes on our website or find us on iTunes and nearly every podcast platform. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Slow Melt. The Slow Melt Maker Series is mixed and produced by Katie Ranke with guidance from Sean Corey Campbell and written and edited by me, Simran Sethi, with support from Sasha Woodruff. Our title track, Soldier, is written and performed by The Slackers. Join us week after next for a Maker Series episode featuring Askenosi chocolate and, of course, another delicious tasting session. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell your friends, consider giving us a review, and subscribe through your favorite podcast app. Choco love and thanks for all your support.